Greetings, everybody around the world. It's time once again for Ancient Aliens Radio. This is the dedicated radio show for the cast of Ancient Aliens. Here we interview authors and researchers as an ongoing investigation into the ancient alien theory. Don't forget to like us on Facebook or subscribe to the YouTube channel, Ancient Aliens Radio.
Today I have my returning guest, Mr. Robert Bovall, with his latest book out. Delighted to see it in print. We have covered this on the show and some of the recent subject matter that's in the book, as most of the listeners will be aware. The book is called Secret Chamber Revisited, The Quest for the Lost Hall of Records. And Robert's going to get into really the premise of the book and why this is being revisited. But as I say, we have covered some of the subject matter and recent events on the show, so we'll tie it in with that as well. But so without further ado, let's welcome our guest. Hi, Robert.
Hello, James. Good to be back.
Thank you, Robert, and great to have you back. Yeah, here we are, Robert, Secret Chamber Revisited, in print. Like I say, it's been a while since we spoke. I know you've been busy to get this thing finished. Great to see it out there, Robert. Tell people a little bit of the premise of the book, Robert.
The book is a revisited or an updating. The first edition called Secret Chamber was published in 1999. Let me put you in the context of why it was published in 1999. There were two things that were building up for the Millennium event. One of them was, of course, the Millennium Party that they were going to do at the Giza Necropolis, organized by Zahi Hawass. I don't know if you recall this. They were going to place a golden capstone on top of the Great Pyramid. Mm-hmm. And the other was that Zahi Hawass had promised for 10 years before that he would finally open the door that Rudolf Ganterbrink had discovered. So I was approached by my publishers at the time, Random House, saying, why don't you do a book on this topic, because it's many people are interested to know what's going to happen and what might happen and so forth. So that's the main reason why this book was written. And of course, the book is divided in two parts. The original book was divided in two parts. One was to cover the historical background to whether there is or there isn't some chamber or hall of records to be found at Giza. Looking at ancient texts, looking at mythologies, looking at legends, and even looking at psychic phenomena like the Casey Foundation, as you know. The other part of the book was the actual search for the Hall of Records, which began in the late 50s and has progressed until recently. So that's how the book was designed. Of course, it's been 17 years now, and there's been many, many other attempts to look for a secret chamber at Giza, hence the update, and also because of the various activities that have been going on in Egypt, the revolution, the dismissal of Zahi Hawass, and the various scandals that have covered this period. As you know, we talked a lot on your show about the Cartouche affair, but what I'd like to emphasize regarding the new book. Mm-hmm. Hello, James.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm listening intently.
Okay, James, as you know, you have to push the pause button with me, right?
For sure. I just like the background of the book, Robert. That's all. I'm listening intently.
All right. Well, the new book was done not only to update, but to bring into sharp focus now with 17 years of further research and investigation, what has been going on behind the scene and the various players that have emerged since I wrote the book in 1999, particularly the National Geographic Society and its hanky-panky with Hawass. So I'd like to kind of focus on this time, because there is various things that have happened, one to you, I gather, James.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I've been regarding sent. this conundrum. So the situation that completely changed everything in Egypt was, of course, the revolution of 2011. By that time, Zahi had become Minister of Antiquities. Perhaps I should explain also how and why Zahi became Minister of Antiquities.
Mm.
The story with Zahi Hawass, with the Giza necropolis, the pyramids and the Sphinx, begins way back in 1974. I covered this on your show many times, so I'm not going to go in detail here, but at that time he was a young chief inspector. And to cut a long story short, he collaborated, and I put this in inverted commas, with the Casey Foundation to help them in some covert way to find the Hall of Records. I must say from the start, and I do say this in the book, I have nothing against Edgar Casey himself. In fact, Casey died in 1945, and I've never met him, of course. I wasn't even born then. And I think he was a genuine person. He really believed in the work he did.
Mm-hmm.
Where I totally object is the way that the Casey Foundation that was formed after his death, and particularly the intervention of Mark Lehner and various other players who have, I'm trying to find the right word here, who have buttered up Zahi Hawass in order to covertly look for this Hall of Records. Again, I'm not against people looking for a Hall of Records as long as it's done with transparency and within the legal boundaries of the law and so forth. But the way this has been done and the corruption that followed and the lies and all the deceits has confused a lot of people. And therefore this is very much where I'm involved in investigating, you know, who has done what and what they shouldn't have done and what they've done which shouldn't have been done. But moving on, Zahi Hawass eventually, and I'm jumping here almost 20 years, in 94 became the Director General of the Giza Pyramids. This gave them total authority on the Giza Pyramids, but still, in a sense, under the Ministry of Culture. His boss at the time was the Minister of Culture, the minister called Farouk Hosni. But they were very, very good friends. And these two had the immense support of the Mubarak family, particularly the First Lady, Suzanne Mubarak. And in many ways, they were untouchable. So, to put it in the simplest possible way, they controlled the Giza necropolis, and no one could do anything there without their approval.
Mm.
And those they did not approve, and I'm included, and people like Hancock and West and Robert Schock and others,
sure,
were barred out. My feud with Zahi Hawass begins in 93.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people need to understand why there is this situation that has reached boiling points in the last few months.
I'm talking the Gantenbrink era.
That's right. And I'm talking about also when I published the Orion Mystery. The Orion Mystery was one of those books that really hit the scene in a big way, and particularly with Egyptology. And Zahi took personal offense to it. He became immediately my nemesis. He couldn't wait to get on radio or on television or in the newspapers, insulting me and calling me all sorts of names, which I became, in a sense, I didn't really mind that much. I mean, I realized that, first of all, he was talking a lot of nonsense, and two is, as you got to know the man, he was that kind of person to act in this way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the story took a different turn when I met Rudolf Gantenbrink in February of 1993, He was just about to start exploring the shafts in the Queen's Chamber. And again, because we've talked about this a lot, let me be brief here. Gantebrig discovered the door, of course, at the end of the southern shaft on the 22nd of March, to be precise, of 1993. And he was blocked by Zahi Hawass and his cronies. They wanted to take the whole thing away from him. After spending 2 weeks there and arguing with Zahi as to how they were going to present this in the press, he realized that he had to go away and do it on his own. So he contacted me I was living in England at the time, and asked me to help him with the media, which I did. And this really started the feud with Zahi and I, because Zahi took particular offense to this, and really he became very, very aggressive, made me all sorts of threats. His favorite accusation, as you know, James, was to try and brand me as some sort of spy. I was often accused of being a Zionist infiltrator, Jewish, trying to subvert Egyptian culture and that kind of nonsense. Mm-hmm. I backed Rudolf Gantebrig to the hilt. I truly believe that Gantebrig not only was the right man to carry on with this exploration and open this door, but it was his right. He is the discoverer. He was mm-hmm. the explorer and discoverer. And it was all wrong for Zahi and others who supported Zahi to take this away from him. And this led to an enormous feud that finally ended up in the high courts of England over copyrights and you name it. Mm-hmm. What was going on at the time, which I didn't know much about, was that the Edgar Cayce Foundation, and let me be precise here, I'm not talking about Edgar Cayce, I'm talking about people who were involved with the Cayce Foundation, particularly the Egyptologist Mark Lehner. You're still there?
I'm here, Robert, I'm listening, I'm just following the story.
Yeah, make a few grunts, because I often think the
I'm muted at this end, Robert. So. Okay.
Okay, well, it's my grudge really is how the son of Edgar Cayce, Ulin Cayce, who also was a rather honest man, mm-hmm. but very naively sent Mark Lehner to basically collaborate in a covert manner with Zahi Hawass in order to obtain permits to look for this Hall of Records.
Almost planted in a way, Robert.
Well, precisely. He was actually planted there. The idea was for him to study Egyptology at the American University and somehow get to know the main players, mainly Zahi Hawass, which worked. So by 1977, the relationship between Lehner and Hawass was consolidated. And they managed to somehow persuade the Egyptian antiquity departments to give a license for an exploration of the Sphinx, or more precisely, to drill under the Sphinx. And this is where the real problem starts, because I think people have to recognize this, because people think that, yeah, why not? Well, first of all, the Cayce Foundation is not an archaeological organization. And let's face it, I mean, the Sphinx is at least 5,000 years old, maybe more, if we accept the geological theories of Robert Schock and the astronomical theories that are presented. It could be 10,000 years old, if not more. Mm-hmm. This is a monument that not only is unique in the world, but because of its age, because of its brittleness, you know, it's actually carved in living limestone. You don't want to mess around with this monument. And if you are going to drill anywhere near it, you want to make absolutely sure that, the best thing is not to drill, all right? But if you are going to drill, you really want to have very specialized drills that are that do not cause too much vibration. And besides, one of the big problems of where the Sphinx is located is that it literally stands a few meters above a natural water table. Now, this is a serious problem and has been a serious problem for the Sphinx for a long time, because the population of Cairo and the surrounding area, the village of Nazareth Salman, has increased to such a degree, and with all the drainage water, with all the irrigation water, has lifted this water table, so it's dangerously about 3 or 4 meters below the Sphinx. But it's protected by a waterproof, if you like, sheet of limestone. And the last thing you want to do is drill into this, because that will allow the water to seep through. And as it goes into the body of the Sphinx, mm-hmm. limestone is very susceptible to excess waters. It will literally powder away. So this is really a shocking thing to realize, that they went there in 78. They rented a drill from a local American who was there. I've actually shown the drill. I've got films of this, as you
mm-hmm,
know.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 4-inch drill powered by a diesel engine, not meant for this work at all.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm not sure what it was meant for.
It's an unusual monstrosity of a drill, Robert. It's like something for breaking up rock rather than actually exploring.
Yeah, you know, for this kind of exploration, you want a pen thick drill, you know, really a very small drill with a low vibration, just enough, by the way, mm-hmm. to insert a fiber optic camera. You definitely don't want a 4-inch drill drilling with a diesel engine and vibrating like a train in full speed and drilling under the Sphinx. Well, they did it. They did five or I can't. It's a bit uncertain, but they did at least 5 holes. Again, I've shown this in photography, and I've got the reports, by the way. Some say they did 8, but I'm not so sure. But even 5 holes under the Sphinx in those conditions was putting the Sphinx in danger. Apart from the fact that they were doing this all very covertly. You know, their intention was very clearly to look for this Hall of Records of Atlantis, which, you know, James, is mm-hmm. anathema to archaeologists and scholars.
Oh, yeah.
And there you are. But if this wasn't enough, what happened afterwards, again, to be brief, when they stopped the exploration of this first exploration in 1978,
mm-hmm.
they offered Zahi Hawass let's put it this way. The biographer of Ulin Casey, the son of Ever Casey, a fellow called Robert Smith, he's now, I'm not even sure if he's alive. The last time I heard of him, he was in his late 80s. Wrote the biography of Ulin Casey, and when he talks about this exploration and the events that followed, he says, or rather he quotes Ulin Casey from recorded tapes that he had, that they arranged for Zahi Hawass to get a scholarship through the Fulbright Fund organization in
mm-hmm.
Cairo.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, Ulin had some influence there. He knew somebody there. And they pulled it off. Zahi got a scholarship to study at the University of Pennsylvania. And there, he spent 7 years. The idea, and they make it quite clear in this biography, that the idea was for him to get a PhD. Frankly, I don't know how Zahi got a PhD with his very dim intellect, but that's another matter.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Anyway, he got a PhD, and the idea was for him to get a PhD because he needed that qualification to move up the ladder in the Egyptian Antiquities organization. And lo and behold, he does return in 1987 and very quickly becomes appointed Director General of the Giza Necropolis. And now, quite clearly from the events that followed, he owned a pound of flesh, as we say, as Shylock in Shakespeare says, to the Casey Foundation. Because after all this expenditure that they occurred, and after helping him get his PhD, they now expected him to get them back to look for the Hall of Records. And they did so once in 1993, when they went there with through a license provided with, to the Boston University through Robert Schock. There they didn't use drills, they used seismographs. Mm. But then we come to 1995, and this is where everything goes wrong. Mm. Because in 1995, two of their senior members, a fellow called Dr. Martin, Joseph Martin Shore, a very rich life member of the Casey Foundation. He was the CEO of a petroleum company in America, pharmaceutical company, and his colleague, a fellow called Joe Jehoda. Both of these characters had been involved in funding and participating in the 1978 exploration, in the 1993 exploration, and here they were now forming another front to cover the Casey Foundation. The Joe Shore created the Shore Foundation and went to Egypt. He knew Zahi Hawass very, very well from the previous encounters, and somehow they persuaded him, and I put this in inverted commas, to allocate them a 5-year renewable license. And, you know, again, Dr. Martin Shore, whom I met many times, as a person, he was a very nice guy. Mm-hmm. But I have explained very, very carefully in the book that I've updated, Secret Chamber Revisited, why this man should never have been allowed to get anywhere near the Giza Necropolis. He had very strange ideas. I mean, apart from looking for the Hall of Records of Atlantis, he had very strange ideas, like many, unfortunately, people in the Casey Foundation, you know, about the Second Coming, how the finding of the Hall of Records was going to somehow usher in a new era of Christianity, of the Second Coming, how Casey prophecies would elevate the Casey prophecies and the man himself into some sort of prophet. Very, very strange. I mean, to allow a man with such ideas to go and mess around at the Sphinx. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What made it even more bizarre, which I found this many, many years later, was that he was not only was a staunch Zionist, and as you may know,
sure, James. Sure, full on, yeah.
I mean, Zionism is, well, I had a huge discussion on my Facebook with people that have branded me as being anti-Semitic. I am not anti-Semitic. It's quite the opposite. I have many, many Jewish friends, and I hate anything to do with racism and ethnic bias and so forth. I mean, I'm not that kind of person. Everybody who knows me.
Semitic and Zionist is two different things though, Robert, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, exactly. And a lot of people don't get this.
Yeah.
Especially
yeah.
in America. I mean, well, let me be more precise here. Being Semitic, being Jewish, and being Zionist are three different things. Mm-hmm. Three different things. Mm-hmm. I mean, not all Jews are Zionist. Not all Jews are Israelis. In fact, the majority of Jews are not Israelis. Mm-hmm. The majority of them live in America and Western Europe.
Sure.
I do not support, I've never supported Zionism. Zionism is a political movement that in my reckoning, and many Jews' reckoning, by the way, has taken over Judaism and has become the spokesman of Judaism, which they should not be. The formation of the State of Israel, well, it exists, and I think that anything that exists has to be recognized and given the right to exist, but I've never approved of what Israel has done over the years. As you know, I'm a staunch supporter of the Palestinian movement, but that doesn't mean I'm anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish. It simply means that I'm anti-Zionist. Having said this, whether I am anti-Zionist is neither here nor there, is that Egypt has banned Zionism. Zionism is an illegal organization in Egypt, and anybody who gets involved with Zionism is in serious trouble. It would be considered high treason. And this is where the whole thing gets very weird, because Martin Shor not only was a self-declared Zionist, but his wife at the time, when he got the licenses, was the head of an organization in America called Hadassah. She was the director, the senior director of Hadassah. Now, Hadassah is the largest women Zionist organization in America and probably in the world.
Wow.
Now, I find it bizarre, to say the least, that licenses were granted openly on a 5-year renewable for those kind of motives to those kind of people, to mess around with these kind of monuments. You know, to say the least, it's particularly shocking.
I think what I like about the new book, Robert, and revisiting this whole saga is we've had another 15, 20 years to look at this again and watch it evolve to another level. And I think what you do greatly, Robert, is you show the historical evidence of the secret chambers and the secret agendas that are going on are not necessarily separate issues. Most often, Robert, they're gelled together. The secret chambers and the historical evidence of them is also wrapped up with murky figures, with secret agendas, and are not separate entities. This whole thing is muddled into one big melting pot, Robert.
Well, I remember a conversation I actually had with Zahi Awas, and yes, I did have conversation with Zahi Awas on several occasions.
Wow.
Not very pleasant ones, but I remember telling him in the presence of Dr. Shor that as long as they messed around looking for the Hall of Records or secret chambers in a covert manner, it wouldn't work. I'm not against looking for secret chambers at Giza. In fact, I'm very keen to find out if there are secret chambers at Giza. But I'm definitely against, one, looking in a hidden and covert manner, not telling anybody what's going on, keeping the information to themselves, handing over licenses to people who are not qualified to do this kind of research, and worse, to pass it on to characters who have very, very odd motives about why they're looking for a Hall of Records. So, to me, it's very clear. As long as we don't clean up this mess, as long as it's not exposed, and as long as Zahi doesn't get out of the way, because, frankly, he's the obstacle there. You know, he has been messing around with people for his own motives, by the way. I don't think he gives two hoots about whether there is a Hall of Records or a secret chamber. His interest is very personal.
I think you're right, Robert. I don't think Hawass cares two bits. I think he cares about lining his pocket with money. That's personally, I think it's all money orientated for him.
Well, we get now to the money business.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what the KC people did over the last 40 years to get those special favors from Zahi. All right, and I won't go any further than to say that, in my mind, he certainly was well pleased with how they dealt with him. All right, so that's as far as I will go on this one. But we know more of what was going on with another organization, starting from 2001, and that is the National Geographic Channel, the National Geographic Society. We did talk about this also previously, but let me be a bit more to the point this time, because there is something going on that is particularly worrying, because behind all this is some very, very important and dangerous and powerful characters that are seemingly pulling strings to either cover up what's been going on or to threaten people who are investigating. I'd like you to tell me a little bit more about a censorship that occurred on your YouTube.
Well, sure. I spoke to you last week, Robert. I mean, the censorship, every time I seem to put a show out about you, Robert, and the Hawass scandal, I either get my monetization taken away, I get I can't upload more than 15 minutes now. So if I do a 1 hour show, I can only put out 15 minutes. And sometimes blatantly the video is taken down. No reason given. And they give a loose guideline that's got no kind of real body of what happened, why it was taken down. It was just, you know, you've hit a community guideline. No reason given. And that's, there's been four separate events, Robert. You know, I know other radio stations that have done different things and in the same way, you seem to be able to get censored on YouTube. People think YouTube is a freedom of speech operating system, but it really is far from that, Robert.
Well, yesterday I did a bit of research, and what was done during my interviews, particularly the one that we pointed out, or I pointed out some strange collaboration that might have happened between Zahi and Masonic involvement. I mean, that is extremely mild compared to stuff that I found on the YouTube. I was researching Zionism just by curiosity, because I had this discussion on YouTube with what was Zionism and so forth. And boy, I mean, there's stuff there that is accusing the U.S. government of conspiracies and so forth. I mean, no, I think there's something else there.
In the way I look at it, though, Robert, I think yes, that's true, and I think there is a lot more wilder stuff. But I think it is wild, and I think there's a lot of you know.
I think we touch a nerve here, James.
I think there's more truth to this collaboration, Robert, and it's got real kind of traceable evidence. Okay. is what I think.
Let me tell you what. I have added in great detail to Secret Chamber Revisited. Let me try and be clear on this one. Since 1993, many, many big networks, and particularly the huge documentary networks like History Channel, Discovery Channel, were very keen to get the exclusivity on the opening of the door that Gantenbrink had found. At the time, I remember I was very, very close to Gantenbrink, and he was puzzled and shocked by the amount of money that was being put on the table to get this exclusivity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people were offering millions and millions of dollars. The reason is that the expectation of a live show to open a door inside the Great Pyramid, well, we don't need to expand on this. I mean, this would have attracted a huge, huge audience around the world.
And it did. It did.
And it did eventually, yes. Well, having said this, who had their eyes on this for a long time was the National Geographic Society. And the story starts with a man called Terry Garcia, who, from what I understand, was at the time working for the Bush administration. He was the assistant commercial secretary. And he somehow got to know Zahi Hawass in the middle 90s. I'm not quite sure exactly when, but I think it was probably 1996, 3 years after the finding of the door and 3 years of hype that was building up. When will this door be opened? Who is going to open this door? And so forth. And the dream of Zahi Hawass, and of course those who would get this exclusivity, was to wait for Zahi if somehow he would make it to become the head of the antiquities, because the decision was out of his hands at the time. The decision was up to the Minister of Culture, and even then it wasn't an easy decision to make, and Zahi had no authority at all at that time. Although he was director of Giza, he had his say in it, but he had no authority to make the decision. However, here is what happened. In 2001, three things took place virtually at the same time. Terry Garcia left the U.S. government, the job he had, and was employed by the National Geographic Society. Terry Garcia proposed to the National Geographic Society to form a television channel, which eventually was created very quickly, called the National Geographic Channel. People in America, surprisingly, don't know that the main shareholder of National Geographic Channel is not National Geographic Society. They only hold about 26 to 28%. The majority of the shares are held by 21st Century Fox, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch.
Wow.
So this changes the picture entirely.
Uh-oh.
Because at that very same time, when National Geographic Channel was formed, with the hope of getting this exclusivity, this mother of documentaries, as I call it, the opening of the door in the Great Pyramid Live, Zahi Awas was appointed by them, by the National Geographic Society, as explorer in residence. So now he was under the payroll, if you like, of the National Geographic Society, and I presume it doesn't take a rocket engineer to work it out. They expected something in return. We didn't know what the payroll was. It was only discovered many, many years later after the revolution that they were paying him at the tune of $200,000 a year on a contract renewable for life. So very lucrative for anybody, let alone an Egyptian minister whose salary is pittance in Egypt.
Rupert Murdoch's a big player on this, Robert.
Well, let me go a bit further on this one. And I'm sticking my neck on this one because I'm speaking facts here rather than theory. So the third thing that happened was that, lo and behold, suddenly Zahi Hawass was appointed as the new the Director General of the Supreme Council of Antiquities. In other words, that he became the boss of all the antiquities. So you had these three events: the formation of National Geographic Channel, Zahi Awas being on the payroll of National Geographic Society as explorer in residence, and now he was in control of the antiquities. And amazingly, and not surprisingly, 2 months later he announces that he has allocated the exclusive rights to National Geographic Channel for the opening of the door live on television, which, as you know, took place in, let me get this right, it was on the 16th of September of the year 2002. And they made a bomb out of this. Excuse me. Rumors are that they pocketed at least something close to $100 million. The show was broadcasted in something like 42 countries. It was syndicated around the world. It was sold to every television channel that was willing to pay, not counting the advertisement and so forth. There was a huge, huge money floating around.
An event this big with 42 countries, Robert, the only thing else that pulls in something close to that is like World Cups and events like that, where there's
The Super Bowl in America, for a start. I mean, I called it the Super Bowl of documentaries, because what this did, and let me tell you, it became the Super Bowl not only because they got the exclusivity, but they hyped it for several months before the show was broadcasted, to a point where not even a Hollywood blockbuster was being hyped like that. Zahi Hawass was recruited to go around the world and give talks, and he went to Asia, he went to America. Mark Lehner, who was also collaborating there, who was also getting a stipend, by the way, from National Geographic Channel, went to various places in Australia and you name it. And they hyped the show with the sort of hype that you wouldn't expect of Egyptologists to do. They were beginning to talk of the opening of a secret chamber. They were insinuating that the treasures of King Khufu were going to be found, or the records of the king, and you name it.
It blew it out of proportion as much as they could, really.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was the idea. Of course, aided by the huge machinery of 21st Century Fox, as you know, the specialists in hyping whatever they want to hype. So this show was the mother of all documentaries. And when it was broadcasted live, even though, as you know, it was a bit of a flop because they didn't find anything. They just found another door behind the Gantry Big Door. But nonetheless, launched National Geographic Channel immediately at the very top of the chart. Its very first show brought it to the top of the charts in documentary making.
You couldn't ask for a better launch than that, Robert.
Yes, and it went on for several years after that. Zahi gave them the show, live shows, six, seven live shows, the Tutankhamun DNA testing live, the opening of the tombs of the golden mummies live, and you name it.
I see a lot of conspiracies, Robert, we haven't looked into properly, but they say that they even faked some of the footage for the exploration of the tunnels.
I don't know. No, I don't think so. But
I think it was pretty real, but I don't know. There's so much even controversy around even what they were doing.
Well, I tell you what is more important to see is that the National Geographic Channel, owned by 21st Century Fox, became so in control of the activities of the National Geographic Society's TV broadcasting that many of its members began to get a bit upset because the quality of documentaries began to fall dramatically.
Wow.
You know, suddenly it was no more the National Geographic sober and serious documentaries on geographical explorations and new scientific ideas. This was all sorts of rubbish that was being broadcasted.
It's a question of reputation, Robert.
Indeed. And one of the members at the time was getting more and more upset and launched a poll because many of them knew and were totally unhappy with the relationship that they had created with Zahir Waz. They had created a sort of Frankenstein, if you like.
Sure.
The idea was to make him into a super star of archaeology, to draw in the public's interest, and at the end to make a lot of money. So shows after shows were being shown, discoveries were practically invented, or all discoveries were regenerated, like the discovery of the lost pyramids and all this kind of rubbish mm-hmm. that went on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was right after the revolution that one of the members of the National Geographic Society decided to do something about this and was utterly convinced, especially after the revolution when the news broke out in the New York Times, that it was found that Zahir Waz had been receiving for his so-called collaboration with the National Geographic Channel $200,000 a year. Now, this pricked the attention of many of the members of the National Geographic Channel, saying, well, we don't get it. Why are we paying this man that kind of money? You know.
Sure.
And of course, it pricked the attention of the U.S. Department of Justice. They didn't need to put two and two together. It was there for them already, saying, well, clearly, it seems that they've been paying him to get special favors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as you know, this sort of behavior by American corporations, especially when it comes to ministers of states in other countries, is considered bribery.
It is bribery. Robert, can we bring in Vokatov? Can we talk about that? Is that too much?
Well, that's what I'm coming at, because there is a man in National Geographic, I will refrain to mention his name, but he was a journalist, and he conducted a poll in 2011 asking the National Geographic members on an open poll, do they want the National Geographic Channel and the News Corporation, it was called at the time. As you know, News Corporation is still one of the companies of Rupert Murdoch and has split into two not long ago into News Corporation, dealing with all the other activities, and 21st Century Fox dealing with TV and media. So they were asking for this man was asking for a poll whether the U.S. Department of Justice should or should not conduct an investigation on the dealings that were going on with Zahir Waz. And so they did. As you know, we didn't know that this was going on. In fact, even the National Geographic reporter, this journalist, was not clear whether there would be an investigation, but it all came out, and you correctly pointed out, it came out when a blog, how do you call these things, a news blog, which was formed in the late 2013, I think it was in the month of September, when it was announced in the New York Times and various newspapers that a certain organization called AGT, owned by a Israeli American born in Haifa, a man called Matti Kotchavi, was going to launch a news blog called Vocative. Everybody was waiting for Vocative to come because Vocative announced that they were going to do what is now popularly known as deep web journalism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Deep web journalism using the equipment that Vocative had in hand because, sorry, AGT had in hand, Matti Kochavi. He was, as many Americans don't know, by the way, he's one of the largest homeland security company.
Wow.
He does surveillance, if you like, on terrorist movements and anti-terrorist activities. He's the man who participated, I'm not quite sure in what capacity, but probably because of his equipment, in the tracing down of Osama bin Laden. Buddy buddies with people like Bill Clinton and various other Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Having said this, when Vocative came out in, I think it was the 27th of October, 2013, strangely enough, the first article that they brought out, now everybody was expecting them to bring out something to do with the big problems that were going on around the world, and particularly in America. If you recall, James, there was the U.S. shutdown, the U.S. government shutdown at the time, when the Republican Party blocked the budget of Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
and the whole U.S. government shut down. But instead of reporting that, the first article that he brought out had the most amazing title, and I'm paraphrasing here, but I think I'm close to it. U.S. Department of Justice investigate criminal charges of bribery involving National Geographic Channel and ex-minister of Antiquities, Zahi Hawass.
Mm-hmm. Do we know where that investigation is at today, Robert? Is it still cloak and dagger?
It's still cloak and dagger. I mean, okay, what happened after that? Was it was picked up, of course, this news was picked up by a few newspapers. I remember Evocative interviewed Zahi, who, of course, went bananas and totally denied any wrongdoing, although he couldn't deny the fact that he was receiving $200,000 from the National Geographic. But he said that they were paying him because he was a consultant, a very convenient term to use.
That's a lot of money for a consultant, Robert.
Well, even if they were paying him as a consultant, it's still considered bribery.
Yeah.
You look, it's very clear,
it's a nice way of saying bribery. It's a nice way of saying I'm being consulted. No, you're being bribed.
Well, I'm not making this up myself. I mean, the U.S. Department of Justice has a department called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. This is a very, very, serious, investigating body. employing, I presume, the FBI and various other organizations to do investigation on corruption that American citizens or American companies get involved with in other countries or in their own country. It's a very, very serious offense. Bribery in America is considered a very serious offense. And by the way, interestingly, because as you know, Rupert Murdoch is being investigated on such charges in England for allegedly bribing or his organization bribing high-flying Scotland Yard policemen and so forth,
yeah.
And News of the World officials and government officials and you name it.
I think everybody knows that Rupert Murdoch has an unorthodox way of going about business, and that's the polite way.
Well, it's official. I mean, there is bribery cases going on in England, but here is the interesting thing: is that no American company and no American individual is safe even if he commits the bribery in another country. Because the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act in America
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
is worldwide. In other words, if you're an American company or American individual committing a bribery in another country, it's considered to have been committed in the United States. So, in this case,
wow.
It becomes very interesting to see what happens with this bribery case that was opened last year in October involving the National Geographic Society and Zahi Hawass. Now, strange enough, well, strange enough, perhaps not, because we know that the U.S. Department of Justice does not, is not transparent until a case has been adjudicated. In other words, that you're not going to hear anything about it until, yes, they found a cause for bribery or not. But it's been going on for nearly, well, actually a year. It's going to be a year next week.
Do you think Vokadov has pursued this case because of who's behind this? Like, are they at loggerheads?
I was waiting for you to ask me this.
Well, it seems like they're going for the bull with the horns, and I think they
Well, you're right. I couldn't figure out why Vokadov would want to broadcast, even though they had the means to find out through their deep web investigation. But why would they want to use this as a banner article in America? I mean, and it got me thinking. It got me thinking because, like I said, the National Geographic Channel is owned in majority by Rupert Murdoch. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if they are found guilty of a bribery case involving Zahi Hawass, and it's a very serious case, this, because it's not only just the National Geographic Society, one of the most prestigious societies in the world, but it involves an ex-minister of state. Yeah. And Zahi Hawass was minister of antiquities and very, very close to the presidential family. So it would certainly make one big fuss, and the buck would stop, I presume, with Rupert Murdoch, since he's majority owner of the company who's been doing the bribing. Mm-hmm. So it got me thinking, well, is that what they want to do? Are they trying to pin a bribery case on Rupert Murdoch? And the answer is, well, maybe. Maybe they're trying to do that, because remember that at the time, the big story was the U.S. government shutdown. And who had shut it down, sure, as every American knows, is the Republicans. And who had been giving the push for the Republicans is the so-called Tea Party. And who are the funders of the Tea Party are two individuals, the richest men in America, Rupert Murdoch and David Koch, one of the Koch brothers. Mm. Now, it may come as a surprise to you, James, that not only Rupert Murdoch, indirectly through National Geographic Channel and Fox Television, was involved with Zahi Hawass since 2001, but who also has been involved with Zahi Hawass and especially the Giza Necropolis is David Koch, the other rich, super rich tycoon and founder of the Tea Party.
Wow.
You may know that David Koch was funding the so-called mapping project of Mark Lehner, yeah, and Zahi Hawass.
Yeah.
And also funded the carbon dating of the, yeah, Giza Necropolis, yeah, in the, I think it was in the middle 80s. So it's pretty bizarre.
It's a small circle, really. The more you look at this, Robert, there's, you know, even if there's not a direct connection, there's a direct connection by motive, Robert.
Well, I think there is a direct connection. I mean, if National Geographic Channel are found guilty of bribing an ex-minister of state, Zahi Hawass, mm-hmm, then the buck stops with 21st Century Fox and its CEO, Rupert Murdoch. I mean, that's where it goes.
You could even sink the channel and have the...
I don't know if it'll sink the channel, but huge penalties are ascribed, and there is even a jail sentence, if I understand.
Yeah.
You can go to jail for 5 years in the States. But this would also completely put into question the credibility of the National Geographic Channel.
Wow, this is taking in a lot of different things. This is taking in politics, history, international bribery, stroke, corruption.
My dear fellow, when it comes to those levels, when it comes to big money, and when it comes to the competitive market of TV ratings, you can expect anything, and you can expect anything with Rupert Murdoch, that's for sure.
I think everything's kind of up in the air with this Department of Justice and the FBI investigations, and I think that, you know, really anything.
Well, having said this, I'm sorry to interrupt you, because the main question is, well, what is going on? I mean, okay, fine, this is what has happened, but is it anything to do with the way your YouTube has been shut down, for example?
Well, I personally think there's four, the only four problems I've had with the channels is to do with videos. Now, one video got took down, Robert, was put back up straight away. And I think it was to cease the momentum that that video was carrying. I even found that it was being carried by a news channel in America. It was getting massive hits, more than I normally get. It was twice.
But you're talking about the videos that we did, yeah, accusing Zahi Hawass and his links with the National Geographic and so forth.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, I'm surprised that so far, because the journalist that has exposed this, if you recall earlier in our discussion today, I talked about the journalist within the National Geographic Society that exposed the hanky-panky that was going on with Hawass. Now, he had a website. I knew this man. I mean, I corresponded with him. And he suddenly was approached by the top lawyers of the National Geographic Channel, presumably Murdoch's lawyers, and they put the weight on him. I mean, in fact, you can go on... well, I don't want to draw attention to him because he got pretty scared about this. Mm-hmm. You know, he actually was forced to close his website and he was threatened to stop harassing, between inverted commas, the various people that he was asking them to come clean on this matter.
Wow.
So I can tell you, he got a pretty big scare.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, I'm not scared because I'm exposing what is not only known on the public domain, but it's true. I mean, there is no, it's not a secret, of what I'm saying. The only thing is that I'm popularizing it because people don't know about it.
But the thing, the world has this thing about free speech, Robert, and it's been rammed down our throats that the world is free and we all have free speech.
Oh yeah, you want to try free speech in America, my friend.
Yeah, it's not really free, Robert, is it?
If people who have big money don't like it, they will stop you.
Yeah, I'm
we'll
sure.
Stop you. I mean,
just for the listeners, remember, this is why I put all the videos up for the Hawass scandal, independently on the website for free, open archives for, anybody who wants to follow this story. At least it's there and it's independent of YouTube and any other, online network. It's on Capricorn members.
What they would do is this. You know, when you have somebody who's controlling the world media, or a large chunk of the world media, and especially in England, we're controlling the tabloids and the various newspapers that can expose all sorts of things. The reason apparently that the police in England were very reluctant to come forward about, the matter with, Rupert Murdoch is that they were a bit concerned about what the papers can do to them.
Oh,
you know, lives have been ruined, reputations have been ruined, you don't want to mess around with with that kind of media.
For sure.
And the same thing in the States. Same thing in the States. You know, I mean, Jesus Christ, the 21st Century Fox, when there was the whole fuss about the Obama budget last year, they went on a rampage. They still are. I mean, all you have to do is switch on 21st Century Fox News, and you'll see. I mean, it's a perpetual attacked on the Democrats and Obama. I mean, they have a lot of sway on public opinion, or at least half of the American voters are on their side. And that's dangerous because you don't want to mess around with that. And what I'm trying to say is that anything that is detrimental or not to the pleasure of 21st Century Fox and Murdoch will either get off the air or you receive a very polite warning to keep off, you know?
Robert, take a moment to give out your website there. We're at the top of the hour. I want to get your website in and where people can get the copy of the book. Amazon on the usual networks, I believe.
If you want to read all about this, and it's an investigation that I did with a lot of gusto because I want to expose all this nonsense. I truly believe that what went on at Giza for the last 40 years has not only delayed serious exploration and knowledge that could have been retrieved from there, but will never stop unless we expose this and it's cleaned up. But anyway, my website, yes, it's www.robertbovall.co.uk. You'll find all the information of my books there. And on Amazon, you'll find the various blurbs written about this book that's just been published, Secret Chamber Revisited. There you are.
Thank you, Robert. Listen, Robert, just before we go, what do we know about Zaihawas today? Where is he in the world? Where is he hiding out, or is he exposing, you know, anything?
We didn't go into detail or at all on the question of the six people in jail, as you know.
The Pyramid Six, yes.
Yes, the trial is taking place in a few days' time, to be precise, after being postponed several times. It's going to take place on the 8th of November, and we're hoping that, let's see what happens, we're hoping that they will be released. But again, there, like it's been happening with the National Geographic and all this conundrum, we feel that there is some interference, and we're very surprised that the court is not willing to listen to the defense of these people. We've provided all sorts of defense to get them out of jail. And Robert, that's another story.
Robert, I believe the Pyramid Six trial is behind closed doors. It's not open to the public. Is that correct?
Well, I was there in March, as you know. Sorry, in September. The trial was supposed to take place, having been delayed several times. It was going to take place on the 14th of September. I went there especially to be present and act as a witness. We presented evidence that should have normally released those Pyramid Six, but they announced that it was closed doors, that we weren't allowed to go in, let alone they didn't want to accept the evidence. So what? You figure it out. And on top of that, it was postponed again, and it will take place, like I said, on the 8th of November.
Oh my God.
I think there's hanky-panky behind the scene, which I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
But we're still going to fight for this. As you know, Sama Karar is very keen to put pressure through the media in Egypt to get those people out of jail.
Wow.
Okay, James, well, I think we covered as much as we can.
I think we did, Robert. Yeah. You know, great to see the book in print now, Robert, at last, and I'm glad I got involved in some of the research and journalism this year. But, keep going, Robert. Who knows what will transpire, and I say...
I said, I'm not giving up on this one. I think this Zaihawas should be brought to justice on all these matters, and and the people who are in jail should be released. I'm not giving up. I'm not giving up. And my book shows it very well. I mean, I have it all intention. And I'm not going to get scared off. Okay?
Sure. Okay. Robert, I thank you for your time today. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
It's a pleasure. Bye, James.